This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching a special series entitled The Drama of Christmas. Now, here's Pastor Sandy with part one of this special series entitled The Drama of Christmas.
We are talking about the drama of Christmas. This morning, we're going to look at the cast of characters. Hey, you would think it would be easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys, especially at Christmas time. Hey, we're told that Santa Claus has it all figured out. He sees us when we're sleeping. He knows when we're awake. He knows if you've been good or bad. So be good for goodness sake. If Santa has the insight to distinguish between good people and the bad people, then it shouldn't be hard for us to tell them apart. This notion is reinforced whenever we come to the Christmas story. For Christmas is a time for some typecasting. The good guys in Christmas stories always appear upright and noble and helpful and innocent, whereas the bad guys, they typically look evil and greedy and sinister. Think of all the Christmas good guys. That helpful reindeer Rudolph, who guides Santa through the night. Frosty the Snowman, who plays wintertime games with the children. The little drummer boy, who had nothing to bring to Jesus but the song he played on his drum. And even George Bailey, in the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life, even George discovered that the world would have been worse off if he had never lived. All these Christmas characters are examples of obvious good guys. But the Christmas villains are just as conspicuous. With termites in your smile and garlic in your soul, you're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. And then there's the infamous Christmas bad guy, Ebenezer Scrooge. Maybe you didn't read the book, but in the book, this is his wish. If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. Boy, oh boy. Makes you want to give old Ebenezer a bah humbug. And of course, the list of Christmas villains wouldn't be complete without the greedy Mr. Potter, the scoundrel who wanted to foreclose on Christmas Eve, no less. For some reason, in most Christmas dramas, good guys and bad guys are portrayed in predictable images. They're envisioned as we would expect them. That is, in all but one Christmas story. The first Christmas, God's Christmas drama, turns these classical representations topsy-turvy, upside down. God uses some creative casting for his Christmas drama. Characters you expect to be good guys turn out to be evil. And the characters you peg as deadbeats and dangerous, they end up being God's heroes in the drama. If you'd been alive at the time, you would have looked at King Herod, the scholars in Jerusalem, even the innkeeper in Bethlehem as the good guys. They were the models of worldly success and religious observance, of fair play and common sense. While the wise men and the shepherds and the two peasants from Nazareth, even the baby born in the stable, were seen by most people as nothing special, perhaps even despicable, examples of the problems that existed in the world at that time. That's how you might have seen it, but you would have been wrong. Once a little boy was standing in the shopping mall. He was right in the middle of the aisle. He had tears in his eyes. He had this frightful look on his face, and he was crying, "I want my mommy. I want my mommy." Well, the shoppers were too busy to stop and help the child, but they had pity on him. And to sort of ease their conscience, they started slipping the boy dimes and quarters as they passed by. Well, finally, a security guard, he approached the youngster and he said, "Don't worry, sonny, I know where your mother is." And that's when the kid turned off the tears. He looked the security guard right in the eye and he said firmly, he said, "So do I, but you better not dare tell anybody." It was one of those situations that was not as it appeared to be, just like the first Christmas. This morning, I want us to examine the cast of Christmas. First, the bad guys, then the good guys. And I think we'll discover that all throughout the year, but especially at Christmas time, appearances can be deceptive. Take King Herod, for example. In retrospect, he ranks as one of history's most evil men. But if you'd been living in Israel at the time, you may have considered Herod one of the good guys. There had to be a reason why everyone called him Herod the Great. Hey, initially the wise men from the east mistook Herod for a good guy. And after all, they were wise men. Remember what Herod told them? In Matthew chapter 2, verse 8, the wicked king said to the wise guys, "Go and search diligently for the young child. And when you have found him, bring back word to me that I may come and worship him also." The wise men were led to believe that King Herod had good intentions. That is, until God warned them in a dream that he was evil. In the eyes of his contemporaries, Herod was impressive. He had the trappings of earthly wealth and affluence. Herod was tall, dark, and handsome. He had broad shoulders and an athletic build. It was said that in his younger years, Herod was good with a bow and arrow, an expert with a javelin. Hey, he was a regular jock on campus. Though Herod was wicked and bloodthirsty at heart, he also had the ability, though, to turn on the charm, especially when it served his best interests. Herod was somewhat as an overcomer. That was how he was viewed. He rose to power in Judea from the ranks of commoners. Herod wasn't even a Jew. He was an Edomite with a Greek name, two strikes against him in Jewish culture. But somehow he used his charisma to win favor with the Romans and gained his position of privilege. Herod also courted the friendship of the Jews. He married a woman with priestly ancestry, and he built this massive addition onto the temple there in Jerusalem. Evidence of Herod's achievements lay just 2 to 3 miles south of the city of Bethlehem. Today, when you visit Judea, in fact, when we go on our tours to Israel, we stay in a hotel where you can see this spot. It's so impressive. From just south of Jerusalem, you can see this massive volcano-shaped cone rising from the desert's edge. It was the site of the Herodium, Herod's great palace. The Jewish historian Josephus said that this magnificent palace had two circular towers, 12 stories high, with 200 polished marble steps leading to its summit. This palace had both hot and cold water, quite a luxury in those days, hot and cold baths, a huge dining hall. It had luxurious gardens. It had a swimming pool twice Olympic size. Parade grounds, 1/4 mile long, adorned the gardens, and a tower that they say you could see the Mediterranean Ocean from Herod's tower. The Herodium was the largest palace anywhere in the world, Rome, Egypt, anywhere. It was a colossal structure that dominated the tiny town of Bethlehem that sat below it. Herod and his Herodium were the epitome of what this world values, both now and then. Power and protection and ease and elegance and luxury and prestige and riches, etc. And all this success was obtained by a ruler who started out a foreigner, a commoner. If you'd been around at the time, you would have labeled Herod the Tony Robbins of Judea, a poster boy for the American dream, a rags-to-riches story. You know, it's sad that we often refer to people like Herod as successful. For how do we know? We see only their wealth and power, and for some reason we think we should respect them. We envy people just because they can buy the larger Christmas tree, or they can give more presents to their children at Christmas time, or they can have a vacation to Colorado during the holidays. Hey, Christmas teaches us that such accomplishments really and truly have nothing to do with success. Understand that underneath Herod's veneer of success was a dark, sinister underbelly. Herod was a selfish man. In fact, he was a control freak. He was willing to go to any extreme to protect his wealth and his power and his status. Any threat to his ego or his position caused his fiery temper to erupt in an explosive rage. Herod murdered the woman he loved and their 3 sons just because he suspected that they were involved in a coup to take over his throne. The Bible also mentions Herod's violent temper. The arrival of the wise men with news of the newborn king upset Herod. Matthew 2 verse 3 tells us, when Herod heard these things, he was troubled, or literally greatly agitated, shook to the foundations. Again, the supposed good guy turned vile and vicious. His temper erupted when Herod ordered the slaughter of the innocent babies, the male babies there in Bethlehem. Innocent blood was slaughtered to appease Herod's desires. Understand, those the world calls good guys often are not. That was certainly the case with another group of people hanging out in Jerusalem at the time of the wise men's visit, the chief priests and the scribes. We're told in Matthew chapter 2, verse 4, that Herod gathered all of the chief priests and scribes of the people together, and he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. Now, these chief priests and scribes, they were the religious experts. In fact, there was a road that led from the priest's neighborhood right up into the temple compound. These men literally lived in the courts of the Lord. They spent each day in the observance of religious rituals. It was their profession to pray and to study and to fast and to search the scriptures. And when they were asked where the Christ was to be born, hey, they knew. They knew the answer. And they gave it to Herod. They said, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written. And they quoted verbatim the prophecy from Micah chapter 5. These were the chief priests, the heavyweights of holiness. These were religious people, faithful church attenders, folks who were up on their Bible, who paid their tithes. They probably participated each year in the Christmas drama or sang in the Christmas choir. They never passed a Salvation Army kettle without dropping in a few coins. They had to be good guys, or so you would have thought. But remember, people are not always what they seem to be. One Christmas, New York City suffered from a garbage worker strike. Not a good thing to have happen at Christmas time. Imagine the stench that rose from all of these garbage bags piled high on the curbs of the streets of New York. One man, though, came up with a solution for his garbage. He took his trash bags and tied red Christmas bows to the top of the bags. And he set them in the back seat of his car. And when he left his car in the parking lot or on the street, he would leave the doors unlocked. So the thief would look into the back seat and see the garbage bag and think it was full of Christmas gifts and take it. It turned out to be an efficient way to dispose of his garbage. But imagine the irony, wrapping garbage in a pretty package. And yet that is exactly what the chief priests and scribes in Jerusalem had done. Hey, they looked like good guys. They were pretty packages. But on the inside, they were full of garbage. Thomas Merton, he wrote, "The ox and donkey in Bethlehem understood more of the first Christmas than the high priests in Jerusalem." Guys, pretty packages can be filled with garbage. The priests knew the exact whereabouts of where Messiah had been born. These chief priests could have gone to worship him, but they were too busy being religious. They were too into their own pursuits. They were too preoccupied with what they were up to and ambivalent toward what God was up to. The hearts of these priests were cold toward God, and so they ignored Jesus. They looked like good guys on the outside, but in reality, they were the bad guys. There's one more bad guy in the Christmas cast, but if you'd been there at the time, you probably would have empathized with him, maybe even appreciated the stand that he took. Understand, population-wise, Bethlehem was just a blip on the screen. Estimates vary from 100 people to 450 people. That's before the census required the crowd to come back. This was not exactly the ideal hot spot for a hotel business. You got to understand that. The local innkeeper had probably made sacrifices to keep his operation open. He figured he was doing the community a favor. He was providing a service nobody else would. And the only reason his hotel was filled up this night because of the Roman census was due to the fact he was the only establishment in town. So why wouldn't he turn away this couple from Nazareth? They had no reservation. They could have made plans like the other people in his hotel had bothered to make. Why didn't they plan ahead like everyone else? All night, he had listened to desperate stories and was forced to turn down people just as needy. Besides, the fire marshal, he might shut them down if he didn't observe the occupancy limitation. He had to stay legal or nobody'd have a place to stay. The innkeeper was just a decent guy trying to make a living. Hey, you don't consider somebody a bad guy just because they throw up a no vacancy sign. This innkeeper was serving his community, being a good citizen. What's wrong with business by the book? Shouldn't a person observe the rules? There's something you need to understand about God. You know, when God gets in the game, the rules change. If God decides to do a new thing or reach a new group or reveal himself in a new way, then it's up to us to change how we do business. It's not up to us to expect God to change. It's up to us to change. When God gets in the game, suddenly the good guys become the ones who are flexible and adaptable and teachable. The bad guys are the folks who refuse to budge. It's ironic, but the person who upholds the status quo, who refuses to compromise characteristics we normally like, can become the bad guy when God decides to do a new work. Flexibility and sensitivity become virtues when God is on the move. I love the little boy who messed up his church's Christmas program. He had the role of the innkeeper, but he didn't like his lines. And so when Mary and Joseph knocked on the door and asked for a room, he responded, "You're in luck. We just had a cancellation." Good guys always make room for Jesus. Well, our bad guys, they look like good guys. Until you take the time to strip away the facade and peer into their hearts to see their true motives and their real attitudes. Herod hid selfishness and violence behind a front of success. The priest hid apathy and coldness toward God behind the drape of religion. The innkeeper hid his inflexibility and his unwillingness to bend to God's will behind the cover of duty and business as usual. See, you have to go beyond appearance to distinguish between good guys and bad guys. Once there was a Christmas pageant that was spoiled by a missing Jesus. Everyone had left the church that Friday night with the life-size nativity set all intact on the front lawn of the church. But on Sunday morning, a key component of the nativity drama was missing. Imagine, someone had stolen the baby Jesus. My word. Well, several days after Christmas, the pastor was taking a walk in town when he noticed that little Tommy Baker was pulling a shiny new wagon behind him. He knew the Baker family didn't make much money, and he admired them for the sacrifice they'd made to purchase this gift. And the pastor went to compliment Tommy on his new wagon when he saw lying in the back, all wrapped up in a blanket, none other than the missing baby Jesus. And he was so disappointed in Tommy. Tommy had grown up in their church. He knew better. Of course, he was a kid, but this crime was of such a magnitude that it couldn't be overlooked. And so the pastor walked up and he dropped his knee down into the wet snow and he started rebuking Tommy for stealing the church's baby Jesus. Well, tears swelled up in the little guy's eyes and he answered. He said, "But pastor, I didn't steal Jesus. I've been asking him for this wagon for so long and I promised that if I got it, the first thing I'd do is take him for a ride." Hey, bad guys can look like good guys, but also the good guys can at first seem to be bad guys. Think the wise men, for example. Magi is the correct translation. And brace yourself. Hey, buckle your seatbelt. I'm about to drop a bombshell on you. The Magi were probably Iraqis. That's right. It's shocking, but the wise men were probably ancestors of Saddam Hussein. That alone would have been enough for us to run them out of town. The Greek historian Herodotus, he said that the Magi were a priestly caste of the Medes. experts in science and mathematics and astronomy and philosophy and law and religion. They served as advisors in the courts of Babylon and Persia. And they rode, by the way, not camels, but Arabian stallions, steeds for war. 6 centuries earlier, they had rode similar stallions into battle against the Jews. And they had conquered the city of Jerusalem, and they had taken the Jews back to Babylon as captives. Now these Babylonians are returning to the scene of their earlier crimes. Hey, imagine your former enemy, a band of wild, exotic, bizarre warriors showing up in your capital city with this vast entourage of supplies and servants. To top it off, they're seeking the whereabouts of a king who will one day rule your land. My first reaction would be to fire up a few cruise missiles. Hey, God's Christmas drama teaches me that just because a person doesn't look like me, or dress like me, or talk like me, or have the same tone of skin that I do, doesn't make them a bad guy. In reality, these mysterious magi, they were unlikely good guys. Years earlier, you see, a Jew had been appointed head of the Magi in Babylon. That Jew was a man named Daniel. And for 600 years, the Magi had been schooled in the Hebrew scriptures and in the prophecies of Daniel. You mean people can go to another church and still know the same God? Apparently they can. What an amazing revelation. As a matter of fact, the Magi may have been better versed in the scriptures than the Hebrews. Which clues me in on how to tell a good guy from a bad guy. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 2, when the Magi rode into Jerusalem, they asked, "Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east," and notice this, "and have come to worship him." Here's how you tell a good guy from a bad guy. Not by his looks or where he comes from or the money he has, but by noting who he worships. Real success is not about obtaining gold. It's about knowing God. Herod and the wise men, they both had gold, but the wise men knew where to lay the gold they had. They laid it at the feet of this newborn king. Good guys, they worship Jesus. Hey, take also these shepherds. In ancient times, you know, shepherds had a, they had a very unsavory reputation. When the shepherds came to town, the sheriff was put on alert. They were usually foul-mouthed and grungy and smelly and dirty and uncouth and uncivilized. Hey, the shepherds were hoodlums. When the shepherds came to town, a fight usually broke out. If you were around a bunch of shepherds, you know what you'd do? You'd immediately put one hand on your wallet and you'd keep it there until you left them. Shepherds were shady characters. In fact, there was a Jewish law that prohibited a shepherd from testifying in a court. That's how much they thought of their testimony. They thought it was incapable of a shepherd telling the truth. Anything he said would be viewed with suspicion. If you had been around at the time, never in a million years would you have considered a shepherd to be one of the good guys. And yet, in God's Christmas drama, they were. In fact, it was to shepherds living out in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night, that news of Messiah's birth was first broadcast in Jerusalem. And remember the shepherds' reaction to the angel's announcement? Luke chapter 2, verse 15 tells us, "The shepherds said to one another, 'Let us now go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has come to pass, which the Lord has made known to us.'"
Thanks so much for joining us today for this special edition of Sandy Adams Radio. We've taken a break from our current series to bring you these special Christmas messages. Since that first Christmas, the story of the arrival of God's Son has been told and retold, even reenacted over and over. The first live nativity occurred on Christmas Eve, 1223 AD, and was organized by St. Francis of Assisi. Since then, thousands of churches over hundreds of years have reenacted the Christmas story. And though we would never discourage a Christmas nativity, these constant rehearsals do immunize us from the wonder of the drama as it first unfolded. Pastor Sandy recently wrote a book entitled The Drama of Christmas that we're sure will bless you. This book is an attempt to spice up your Christmas by recapturing the surprise, the fascination, the awestruck amazement that first accompanied the Christmas drama. The Christmas story is the world's grandest epic. We would love to get this book, The Drama of Christmas, in your hands. To receive your own copy, log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on The Drama of Christmas right at the very top of the homepage. Each copy is only $10, which includes shipping. Again, to receive a copy of The Drama of Christmas by Sandy Adams, visit sandyadams.org and click on The Drama of Christmas at the top of the homepage. On behalf of Pastor Sandy, the congregation at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain, and the entire production team, we want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.